Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Wednesday, 6th of January, 2021, and we have some results rolling in from these U.S. Senate runoff races. And it appears that both races are set to go to Democrats, especially even though it's a razor-thin margin. The tilt's becoming more and more towards the Democrats as the last votes roll in from mostly urban districts. And there's 2% yet left to count, but as I've watched the development this morning, it's gone quite clearly, mostly towards Democrats. And Goldman Sachs is calling both races, and New York Times, I think they've only called one, and the media networks have only called one, but the other they're projecting is tilted that way as well by about a 1.1% difference. That's the Ossoff-Perdue race going now, tilting more and more towards Ossoff. So we have an outcome that the market is already trying to trade. This does give the Biden administration control of the Senate, if by a bare one vote, a tiebreaker from incoming Vice President Kamala Harris. And that means, of course, that the Democrats, while you call it the blue wave scenario, it is not a blue wave. It's a blue half wave or ripple. Some I've even seen it called. They can do policy. But they can't do dramatic policy with this type of majority. But markets drawing conclusions. We have the Nasdaq down 200 points, getting close to 2% now overnight. That's much larger, Peter, than the more modest 0.3% decline in the S&P 500. We've talked in the recent couple of days about the technicals. We had a kind of an ascending wedge, and looks like around 10,500, as you pointed out in an internal meeting, is a key maybe pivot level lower. Also note that 21-day moving average was tested twice, and it's currently trading well below that. What's your takeaway? Is this the interest rate sensitivity story we talked about? Is it the big mega caps and anti-monopoly? What's the fear for U.S. indices here on this election outcome?
We actually covered it in our pre-election analysis on equities, and I think it's foremost a technology regulation and the potential, or at least the increased likelihood of a change to the corporate tax rate structure. You could always argue how much they actually want to dare move on the corporate tax rate in the first year, so in 2021, because of the overhang in the economy. But maybe they have 2 years at least with this majority, slim majority. So maybe it's a 2022 thing with the corporate tax rate. So that's obviously has to be discounted in the markets. But then also there is the interest rate sensitivity. We're pushing above 1%, and Altea will take us through what that means in a few minutes. And that really impacts the marginal parts of the equity market where funding is the most in need. So that's high growth stocks, companies with negative free cash flows. It's the SPACs, it's the private equities, all those corners that really need financing, which will be squeezed on a more interesting alternative, which is the rising interest rates. Because with the Biden administration getting this small majority, I think it's pretty given that there will be a higher fiscal stimulus coming, because the Democrats wanted a bigger fiscal impulse than what the Republicans were willing to provide to the U.S. economy. So I think that's one of the things that will change this next year, that we'll get even more stimulus.
Yeah, so what we're seeing is the reflation trade. This is the accelerator. I mean, the biggest accelerator of reflation trade would have been a stronger blue wave result already back in November. But this is sort of the mini version, the light version, LITE version of this, if you will. So we're seeing reflation trade being expressed across the board. We have a weaker dollar on that anticipation of stimulus, which drives even larger U.S. external deficits and leaves that big question mark over funding. I want to skip the commodity bit just for a second, because we need to get to yields here. And yields, to me, and I think for many of us, is really the key. We've been pondering what happens if U.S. yields break higher. They're trying to do that right now, or they are doing that right now. The question, of course, will be if they hold. We have the 10-year benchmark above 1%. You can see that on slide 7. And on slide 6 earlier, I had popped in a slide for the 30-year, which is critical for the longest end, and especially for the U.S. housing market, popping of 1.75%. I'll tell you, what's the view here? At what level do you think this really starts to set the market on edge? For this steepening trade?
I think that John, having the 10 years at 1%, should already have the market being more cautious. And in the past 2 days, we have seen this trend, especially in the corporate space, because as of Monday and Tuesday in the US, we have seen around $40 billion of new bonds issued in the corporate space. This basically what is saying is that the corporate world is scared of a rise in refinancing risk, and that they are taking the chance now that the yields are still low to go in the primary market and issue more debt. But I think that there is a point that Peter has brought up before, which is the rate sensitivity topic, which is very important and will affect high duration bonds. And if we see in slide 8, here we have the yield curve, the 5 years and versus the spread between the 30 years and 5 years treasuries in blue, and in green instead the spread between 10 years and 2 years. And what we are seeing is that the longer part of the yield curve is steepening faster. And just between the begin from the beginning of the year until today, the 30 years and 5 years steepened by 10 basis points. These 10 basis points has been reflected mainly all in the 30-year treasuries, and basically it produced a loss of around 2% in the price of 30-year treasuries. So if we see 30-year treasuries from now until the end of the year rising to 2.5%, this will result in a loss of around 15%, which is a major story out there.
Yeah, and you pointed out in the special edition podcast we did just before year end a lot of these interesting, very interesting dynamics, and just the lack of any safety from these very low yields, which could mean for a net negative year for treasuries, which is a rare thing indeed. And Peter, you we did a podcast about a week before that, or a little bit more on equities and especially that interest rate sensitivity. I encourage that's very it's a fairly timeless a podcast there back on December 22nd. So if you'd like to go back into the back catalog there, I would encourage listeners to have a listen to those two podcasts. Now, Ola, we're getting all guns firing here on this reflationary front because we talked yesterday about a very ugly turnaround that looked bearish that first session of the year for crude oil, tried to break higher and then ended the day lower just ahead of this OPEC meeting. But now it's burst back higher. I assume that's in part because of Saudi Arabia's move, but maybe there's just the general background of all this other stuff contributing as well.
Well, John, no doubt that the what we increasingly can call the guardian of the oil market, Saudi Arabia, they surprised the market yesterday. We from talking on Monday about Russia wanting to see production up by 500,000 barrels next month, basically a continuation of the increase that we've seen so far this year. They basically in the end agreed to a rollover, and at the same time Saudi Arabia popped this surprise announcement that they were going to cut production by 1 million barrels both in February and March. The market took it very obviously very positively. The momentum right now remains favorable, and the reflation is part of it. So people are not only buying oil because they think demand is going to go in, up in the over time. They're also buying oil as a reflation hedge against what's unfolding elsewhere. So it's a twofold story, and neither obviously have any need to worry much with the price action we've seen today. I think the question is really to ask is why did Saudi Arabia do it? And I think the answer to that is basically that they are seeing weakness emerging on the demand front. We're seeing all lockdowns being enforced once again across at least the Western world, and there are some stories about the new cases also emerging in Asia. And it just basically means that the demand outlook is completely clear as mud right now in terms of when we're going to see a recovery. So it's just a precautionary step, but one that potentially will support the market through these very challenging months that lies ahead. And if I may just finish off the oil section, we got a inventory report coming out today. The API and EIA both looking for a drop in crude oil stocks, but against that, gasoline and diesel stocks saw quite a big increase by the American Petroleum Institute yesterday. So bit of a mixed report, but the Saudi story and the reflation story are the two main focus points right now.
Yeah, and with that reflation story, we've talked about this year potentially being a remarkable year for commodities and a resurgence. And Peter, you've put considerable effort into identifying companies that will trade procyclically with any rise in commodity prices. So there was this commodity sector basket I think you've identified. You've got some data for us on slide four, taking through what's already been a pretty solid performance for just the first 2 days of the year.
Yeah, exactly. We published the other day this Saxo commodity sector basket, and it's up already 4.4% as of yesterday's close. And given the price action I'm seeing across the board this morning in Europe and Asia, I would suspect this commodity basket to be up even more. You can see the performance over the past 5 years. It's a dramatic turnaround from the lows in March, and it's a portfolio that provides you with a pretty good dividend yield. You can see that on the insert as well on slide four. So 3.7% dividend yield. The price to cash flow is only 7.6 times on a forward basis. It's a modestly valued part of the equity market, and that's your tailwind. It's always when you get multiple expansions and a change in the trend that you're really getting attractive returns, and that is what I think we are looking at here with the commodity sector. And I just also on the chart to the left on the on the same slide four, you can see that we have regressed the excess return in this commodity basket versus the MSCI world. So basically your alpha, so the commodity sector's ability to deliver higher returns on a monthly basis versus monthly percentage point changes in the underlying inflation by the New York Fed, which is this very broad measure looking at a lot of online and offline prices. So not your CPI or PCE core, it's a much broader measure. And as you can see here, there's a positive relationship in these data, and you can see that in the chart as well. You see a very, very aggressive price performance for commodity stocks at the beginning of 2016 till around the mid 2018, when inflation pressures began to taper off, and the rest is sort of story. So if we are right in this reflation story, you as an investor want to have exposure to this commodity sector, because it will probably has a good likelihood of providing you with alpha and outperformance. And also on slide three, we know that typically in a reflationary scenario with a weaker dollar and a stronger commodity markets, emerging markets tends to do quite well. And that's also basically what we're seeing. We're seeing investors repositioning their portfolios into markets like the Chinese and the South Korean, which we are highlighting today on slide three. You can see there, it's a really aggressive move. Just a very quick comment between those two markets. As we said yesterday, the Chinese market, I have a little bit worries about because of their very high net debt levels to operating profits. I don't really like the financial leverage in the private sector in China, whereas the South Korean one is much more balanced, and also like the valuations better there. So that's sort of our take for now. Overweight emerging markets, overweight the commodity sector, play on this reflation story.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just to add in as well, Peter, with the emerging markets, emerging market growth is much more commodity heavy than developed market growth. So if the growth is skewing towards the emerging markets, and that will also ensure increased demand for commodities, just as a note.
Yeah, and all part of this is that weaker dollar, which we are seeing across the board. There's not a whole lot of differentiation, and leading the pack, no surprise to see CAD snapping back very aggressively with whiplash inducing turnaround in crude, if you will, but also the Australian Kiwi dollars. I've got those, or at least the Australian dollar versus the US dollar on slide five, where it's even beginning to pressure the upside of that very rather aggressively higher sloping channel. The next big resistance levels here across the board, 80 to 81 in Aussie, and then on euro dollar, the 125 plus resistance. If this knee-jerk reaction holds, I think we can follow through a bit, a couple percent here, let's call it, on the dollar. But I just think that there's a background, and we can't emphasize enough, you have to watch these US yields. this is very meaningful stuff. And I think maybe we can stay complacent for some amount of time, but at some level that becomes a, there's some cognitive dissonance and stress in the system if yields continue to rise in the US with no indication, very important, with no indication that the Fed is about to step in and do yield curve control. So maximum leeway, I would say, in the 10-year is towards 1.5%. That's a massive level on the charts. Let's not forget that a 2% Fed funds rate plus minus a few basis points and 3% 10-year rates essentially broke the world. And that was before COVID-19 and before we added all this debt in response. So that breaking the world level has gone lower. Where is it? I don't know, but there is some dissonance or there is some stress in the system if U.S. yields continue higher. That would be my one sort of cautionary note, broadly speaking, for all of what we're discussing today. And then on the inflation front, just a key to sort of pull this out of the data stream and the macro releases, yesterday's December U.S. ISM manufacturing was surprising with a strong read of 60.5. And of course, that was stronger than expected. Takes away from the narrative that there may be some slowing in the U.S. economy. But interestingly, the prices paid index at 77.6. You can see this on slide 9 with the black being the ISM prices paid, one of the highest readings in modern history, a couple readings in early 2018 when the dollar was also weak. And you can see the crude oil price I've put in blue is a key driver. So you have to watch that for risks that we could be headed to new highs. Yeah.
I just want to quickly chip in on this ISM manufacturing prices paid index, because it's when we have reached levels above 70 or 75, it's typically been around high levels of inflation in the US and pressure on profit margins and earnings growth for S&P 500 companies. I think the reason why the snapback from, you know, the low 30s to now 70, 77 in the prices paid index, obviously, I think it's probably due to some not normal circumstances, in the sense that if you look at the Chinese PPI index or the producer price index, it hasn't snapped back to the same degree. So I think the some of the price hikes that we're seeing is a bottleneck issue right now on the supply side of the global supply chain. So we know we have a lot of maritime workers that have been working overtime, and it's very difficult to source people to do the shipping right now. So shipping freight rates, we also have logistics issues in ports in Europe, other bottlenecks like last mile delivery. Is causing some problems, and I think that is what is causing this temporary spike in the prices paid right now in Europe, in the US by companies. I think the Chinese PPI index, which is also moving higher, so we need to focus on that. I think that's the real driver of sustained inflation, because it's the world's factory basically. So if they are hiking prices, it will feed through more broadly and more sustainable through the entire global supply chain. So that's the one to follow, and we'll do that over the coming months and update you on that.
Yeah, there was some sub-index somewhere I saw of the supply or the delivery times being rather extended, and that also feeds the argument, like you say, and when you have the stimulus like you saw in the COVID pandemic, whereas the on the supply side from China, they were dealing with a total shutdown themselves and getting back up to speed and all the logistics and shipping. So yeah, it will be extremely interesting, A, in the March-April timeframe when all the basing effects start to kick in and we can expect the year-on-year inflation levels to start pulling a little bit higher at least. And then B, how quickly those logistics issues unwind. Ola, did you want to talk about the important massive surge in grain markets before we get to the calendar slide?
Yeah, just briefly, John. It's already a long one, but this is just adding to the food or the price pressure coming from commodities. Just take a look at corn and soybeans, two very key ingredients from a global perspective. We've seen a surge there continue into the new year. A lot of that has been driven by developments in South America. Argentina, they had some port strikes, which has left the biggest exporter of soy meal or soy products. At the same time, we got the La Nina, which is increasingly creating dry patches across both Argentina and Brazil, thereby raising concerns about their current crop. So we got these markets tearing higher right now. Obviously, a lot of that is speculative driven, but we are the market will be nervous ahead of the U.S. planting season, which will start in a few months' time, because for a change, the market is really looking at a situation of tightening supply compared to what we've seen in the previous 4 to 5 years.
All right, important stuff, especially as for the CPIs and places in the emerging markets where the food component is much higher in their inflation basket or the CPI basket. Okay, let's go to the calendar. We've got the releases for the services. Well, these are the final versions of the December PMI. They don't usually garner much attention. ADP employment change could be interesting out of the U.S. later ahead of the Friday non-farm and full U.S. employment report. And then we have the FOMC minutes. We've seen a couple of mixed signals from different Fed voters. Evans seemingly on the dovish side and Bostic already talking about tapering. I think that's an interesting bit of fantasy right there. And then, of course, we need to watch with this whether this entire reaction to the Georgia Senate runoff races, sticks and deepens. And it looks like U.S., at least the high-flying mega caps, are quite nervous on this. We've kind of outlined why that would be the case and how it could continue to be the case as we run through what this what the implications are for U.S. rates, which to my mind are the most key thing to track here in the next several days. With that, we'll see how it all turns out, and we'll be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call for today. Thanks for joining.